Micah, you have a dirty secret. That is that you're an evil Calvinist. Is this true? Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. So briefly explain what Calvinism is and why most Christians today in America in particular would find it controversial.
Calvinism is the belief that God is sovereign in salvation. So when someone is saved, so when someone, their heart is changed, they become a Christian, they will eventually go to heaven and they become a part of God's kingdom. That whole process is not something they get the credit for. It's something God gets the credit for. The Bible teaches that we're all desperately sinful, that we rebel, that we seek our own ways, that even if we know stuff about God, we still want to be our own boss. And the only way to get out of that situation is for God to actually change our hearts. And so Calvinism teaches that God is sovereign in that process. And the reason we emphasize that so much is so that God gets all the glory and all the credit for salvation. The Bible says, not by works, so that no one should boast. So that's a really good test. If you conceive of salvation in a way that you can boast about it and say, I was smarter, I was better, I blah, anything that gives you kind of a ground for thinking that you played a hand in your salvation shows that you're going astray. And so Calvinism emphasizes that God is sovereign in who is saved and who is not, and that he gets all the credit for it. The reason it's controversial is because people think, hey, if that's the way it works, why doesn't God save everybody? Mm-hmm. And the answer is, he could, but he chooses not to.
I see you've also very strategically left out the F word here, free will. What would be your position on that?
I would say we do have free will to do what we want to do, but we want to rebel. We want to do what we want to do.
As listeners of this show will already know, and anyone who has talked to me for longer than 10 minutes will know, I endorse the position commonly called Molinism, or the view that God has middle knowledge. And essentially what this says briefly is that God, I actually agree with almost everything that you've said there, just not in the way that you mean that. But it says that human beings do have free will in the libertarian sense, that we're not determined by our desires. They can influence us, but ultimately our own decisions are within ourselves and we can turn ourselves whichever way that we choose to, even going against some of our desires if that is what we choose to do. So that's the libertarian view of free will. And what you've described is what's philosophically called compatibilism, or the compatibilist view of free will.
Right.
Yeah. And there's one additional doctrine to middle knowledge, or to Molinism, and that's what's called middle knowledge. Mm. And this says that God knows everything that a human being could choose to do, every possible choice. He also knows every choice that we will make in the future, in the world that he has created. But in addition to that, he knows every choice that we would freely make if we were in any possible circumstance in any way that he chose to create the world. Where I would disagree with you, or where I disagree with the Calvinist point of view, is like what you were saying, that why doesn't God save everyone? Why does he not overwhelm everyone in what's called the irresistible grace that is included in the Calvinist scheme?
Okay. Yeah, so I guess a couple of things to note. One is the irresistible grace mm-hmm. phrase can be misleading because it sounds like people are dragged into the faith kicking and screaming, when the reality is that it is the will itself that is the problem. It's the will that is slave to sin, and in the act of regeneration, when someone is born again, it is their will that has changed. So there is no kicking and screaming. It's like it's like a blind person who suddenly sees. They see the beauty, they see the excellence of God, and they're drawn to that. And so there is no kicking and screaming or grace being resisted in that way. So to answer your question, why does God not save everybody? Romans 9 seems to indicate that God is in some way glorified by both saving and by condemning sin. When he condemns sin, when sin is punished, that shows his glory to be of utmost value. When someone is saved by grace, that also shows his glory, showcases his glory. So I think both are there. And to say, like, well, I think God should save everybody, I mean, it's hard to prove that. That's one of those cases of, well, if I were God, I would do blank, but we're not, and so it's not ultimately up to us. So let me push back on libertarian free will within the Molinist circumstance. So you said that someone can go against, they can choose to go against their desires, but why would they do it? Wouldn't that just mean they have a stronger desire? You're always going with your strongest desire by definition, right?
One could conceive of it in that way. I think ultimately what I mean by that is compatibilism sort of collapses human decision down to almost an algorithm, like you said, whatever your strongest desire is. Hmm. But if there are equal desires, for example, conceivably, then you could choose between those two options. Ultimately, what I'm saying is that the desire itself is not causally sufficient to bring about the choice. In other words, I have to agree with my desire, as it were, in order to bring it out into the world.
That still sounds like you have to desire your desire. Like you have to have there has to be a reason that you choose one over the other.
Yeah, certainly.
So I'm not saying it's like causally determined by your biochemistry or whatever. I'm not saying that. I'm saying people choose things for reasons. Yeah. And a lot of times when I hear about libertarian free will, it's like, yeah, you have your reasons, but then you got to decide amongst your reasons, and there's some additional factor that can't be described as a desire or a reason, and I don't know what that is.
Yeah, it does get to be a little difficult to describe it. The issue is, I suppose you could say that you can actually genuinely make a random decision if you wanted to.
But if it's random, it's irrational.
Well,
right?
Yeah, I could. Yeah, it definitely could be irrational. I guess the idea here is that what you're just calling a desire is simply just a choice. But I think that we've experienced this in our own lives. There are times whenever we do things that we don't want to do, and we go through the motions even though we don't want to do it.
Oh, but it's because you had a stronger desire to do it. Like, let's say my youngest child needs a diaper change. I really don't want to change it. Mm-hmm. But I have a stronger desire that the diaper be changed than that it not be changed. And so my desire to not change it is overcome by this other desire. So ultimately, the strongest desire always wins out. By the way, if you're listening and you're thinking of reading Freedom of the Will by Jonathan Edwards, I think we just basically gave it to you in a couple of minutes. So that's the basic gist of the argument, is Edwards setting up this idea that you always follow your strongest desire, and any objection can always be collapsed back down into the strongest desire. Because otherwise you're doing stuff for no reason, which doesn't make any sense.
So that would almost say that no irrational person exists.
Let me think about that. Well, I mean, you can have dumb desires. You can do dumb things.
Perhaps you can do things for no reason whatsoever. And that isn't to say that libertarianism says that you don't do it for reasons. But, you know, reasons and desires may not even be the same thing.
Hmm.
I could have a reason to do something, but not really a desire to do it.
Hmm.
It's conceivable either way. But I don't think that the language there – I think it's more of just a semantic issue, that what I call a choice, you call a desire. We may be describing the same thing.
Yeah,
the ultimate question is whether or not it's determined, causally determined in one way or another.
Are you worried about causal determination outside of a person or even within a person? Because we're both talking about stuff that's inside a person, right?
Yeah, I suppose. I think the main issue would be divine determination. So it doesn't necessarily have to – so actually it would have to be, technically speaking, outside of the person.
Mm.
In a certain sense, you could say that – perhaps you could say that a person is determined by their desires, and technically that's within them, but that's not the complete system. The complete system involves God at some point creating them with those desires.
Mm-hmm.
And so then it gets into what your philosophy of agency is. And so for me, I have a very hard time – seeing this system where God gives a person a desire wherein they are incapable of choosing more than one option. They're always defaulting to their greatest desire that they never really desired in the first place. In other words, that system to me seems to collapse God into the only agent in the whole system.
Well, I mean, I do believe that God is sovereign, but there is this idea of secondary causes that, mm-hmm, you know, for instance, like someone does something evil, God is sovereign over that evil. I mean, the ultimate example would be these people who wickedly killed Jesus, right? They did it. They're responsible. They chose to do it. But ultimately, God is sovereign over that. That was part of his plan. I think you've got to have both.
Definitely. And actually, from a Molinist perspective, I would actually say that the Molinist exegesis of Acts 4, which you're alluding to, is the most, at least for me, it's the most intellectually satisfying. Because I believe, I'm going from memory here, so forgive me if I don't get it exactly right, but Peter is preaching, and he said that the Jews and the Romans and Pontius Pilate, mm-hmm, and King Herod all came together to do what your plan and your hand had predestined to occur.
That's exactly right.
And I completely agree with that. I mean, I have to if I'm going to be a Christian.
Yeah.
But from a Molinist perspective, you can see where God sovereignly brought about these events, where these men, knowing what they would do in that circumstance, freely brought about the execution of Jesus for God's sovereign plan.
But there's a hidden problem there, though. Mm-hmm. The Molinist is saying God has knowledge of counterfactuals. He knows what all these people would do in a given situation. But that also means God's plans are constrained. God is choosing amongst several different possibilities. There's a limited number of possibilities based on what people would freely choose to do. And, right. I mean, that seems to undermine God's sovereignty a bit.
It limits it. Well, okay, so we need to get a couple of definitions here. Mm. So when I'm using the word sovereignty, I mean this. I mean that everything that occurs in reality either occurs by one of two ways. Either God directly causes it by himself, or he allows it to come about, like you said, through secondary causes. So everything that occurs is either by God's direct causation or it's through his permission. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I mean by sovereignty. Now, if you're talking about options, it's important to understand there's a distinction between bringing about something and bringing about something through a certain channel. So I believe that God can bring about anything that is logically possible, any logically possible circumstance. However, the channels to bring about those circumstances may not be equally open to him. So for example, well, let me choose a non-controversial example. Can God raise Jesus from the dead? Is that possible?
Mm-hmm.
Right. I should hope it's possible because I think that's what happened in history. But could God bring it about so that Jesus rose naturally from the dead? Without miraculous intervention, the normal natural causes of the universe, Jesus rises from the dead.
I don't think so.
Right. That is not a channel that is open to God. But we're not, you know, we're not limiting his sovereignty because that's an incoherent statement.
Right.
You know.
Right.
So that's what I think is the case with free will. What you're saying, God can bring about anything that he wants if he determines those creatures. But if he gives them libertarian free will, then yes, by definition, he is going to be constrained because he cannot make someone do something freely.
I see. So the parallel between the two statements is God cannot naturally do something supernatural or make something supernatural happen naturally because it's an incoherent statement. And you're saying he cannot
make someone freely do something.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, that would be.
But doesn't that suggest this idea that God would have these moments where he thinks, oh, I wish I could do blah, but this stupid free will is messing me up?
In those cases, Molinists have different responses. I'm going to call out a guy right now. William Lane Craig says this, and it drives me insane. He says, and I quote, God has to deal with the hand that he has been dealt.
I was just going to bring that up.
That drives me insane because it's very misleading, but that's his view. That is his view. He does agree with you that there are times when God says, dagnabbit, I can't do this. I can't bring it about. This free creature won't cooperate. I don't believe that. I do think that God may think, I would like for this to happen through free will, but this creature won't cooperate with me. That's true. But God can also say, I will determine this creature to do it. And he can interfere with their free will at that point in time. Hmm. Or God can even say, he can go, going all the way back to the beginning of creation, he knew what every free creature would do. And so he may think to himself, I want to bring about a world where X, Y, Z happens. But it turns out that there are no free creatures that would cooperate with me to bring that about. Well, I'm going to create a world with determined creatures to bring that about. I think that's totally coherent.
Well, let me ask you a question that I think a lot of Molinists get asked. If God knows what every free creature would do in a given set of circumstance, doesn't that imply that the circumstances determine what their action is?
No, the circumstances are not causally related in any sense.
Right, but God is setting up the circumstances so that in those circumstances they would do something. Yeah. Oh, I say, but they're not causally.
They're not causally determined. God just happens to know what they would do. So, to put it in another way, consider, for example, someone flipping a coin. Mm-hmm. You know, and we'll assume that it's an indeterministic. I know, you know, that's not technically true, but we'll assume that it is. Just by calling all of the numbers correctly, that doesn't in any way determine what comes
out. Oh, I see. Right. It's the two senses of determine. He can know it, but without causally.
Right. So it's epistemically determined. Mm-hmm. In other words, your thoughts are closed. There's no new information that can come in that can change anything. In fact, for God, there is no new information at all that can come in because he's omniscient. Hmm. So the path, to put it in these terms, it's causally open, but it is epistemically closed.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that's just a consequence of omniscience.
Yeah.
Okay. You have to admit it sounds weird, though, to say, given the circumstances, I know exactly how you will behave, how you will respond, but those circumstances do not cause you to do it.
Right.
Like if one person had that knowledge of another person, you could totally manipulate the other person to like arrange the circumstances and I show a red card to you and I know what you're going to do when I show up the red card.
Watch the movie Minority Report. It's all about that.
I know that yeah. movie makes no sense. All right, that movie makes no sense because basically all time travel movies where time travel goes from the future to the past involve contradictions.
Yes.
Back to the Future involves a contradiction.
Yes.
Minority Report involves contradictions
yes.
because the information travels to the past and prevents itself from existing.
Well, okay. So I happen to like – I think Minority Report is internally consistent if you make the proper epistem or proper philosophical distinctions. I think that the precogs, as they're called, the mutants there, I think they had middle knowledge. So their knowledge, they weren't seeing the future, but they were conceiving of it. And so this is actually important from a theological perspective because God doesn't see the future like it's an existent, like a thing that's out there, but he can conceive of it in his mind and know what would happen.
Hmm.
Now I think it's annoying because the precogs in the movie, at least, they were showing like video of it.
Mm-hmm,
Which, you know, now you've got photons involved, you've got causal relationships.
Wait, I have another question about Minority Report.
Yes.
Usually, the precogs would see what would happen if no one acted on their information. However, in Tom Cruise's case, they saw what happened because someone acted on what they saw.
Yes, okay. That is definitely a plot hole. But yes, I mean, it is a movie. It's a good movie. You should definitely watch it. In fact, if you're A&M, you have to be careful, though, if you try to get it from the annex, because I tried to watch it all last semester, and there was some course that had it on course reserve. It was never available.
Some, like, philosophy course or something?
Or maybe a legal course, because it's really interesting. Like, if you're stopped from doing the crime, are you still guilty?
Hmm. Oh, there's a related question.
Yeah.
I heard an interesting podcast from Radiolab, and all the people on Radiolab are more or less naturalist, or they operate from that point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And from that perspective, they would say like, oh, let's say a mentally ill person commits a crime.
Yeah.
Well, we don't necessarily put them in prison. We say, well, they're mentally ill, and that's why it happened. But they argue like, if we're all just a bunch of molecules, and it's all biochemistry, isn't all crime, isn't it all just mental illness?
Mm-hmm.
And from that standpoint, it's no longer about punishing crime. It's more about, you know, preventing it, putting this person in a position where they can't do it. And from that perspective, it becomes totally plausible to lock people up because they're mentally predisposed to commit certain kinds of crime,
mm-hmm.
right? And you could tell, like listening to this podcast, that these naturalists were uncomfortable with which direction their worldview mm-hmm. was taking. And you could imagine like, oh, you know, you're treating people as causally determined. It's going to put you into some very ethically murky waters very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a great example of like, naturalists not wanting to live with the kind of the consequences of their worldview.
Yeah, yeah, it's dealing with ethics, but you know, responsibility kind of a thing. That's what really bugged me about Minority Report is they try to convict people on this pre-crime thing,
mm-hmm.
and it's like, I mean, I'm not a legal expert, but we also have like attempted murder kind of charges.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can get arrested for that. You know.
Based on what your intentions were and that sort of thing, yeah.
Yeah. It's something that, and here's my Jesus juke, it's something that the state cannot do, and that is look into the heart of man, but Jesus can.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that's something that's interesting from a Christian perspective is that even though we can say that from a legal perspective it's not clear how to prosecute these people, we can say that just by having the desire in your heart or wanting to sin or conceiving of it in your own being, that in and of itself is sufficient to be condemned in the divine court.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Hey, you want to hear a good Think Theism movie?
Yeah, definitely.
Children of Men.
Children of Men.
Have you seen this movie?
I actually don't think I have.
Okay. Go watch it.
Okay.
It's amazing. The premise of the movie is mass infertility.
Oh, okay.
How would the planet respond in such a circumstance? The youngest person in the world is like 18.
Interesting.
It's very well done. It's the same director that directed Gravity.
Gravity. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So he's like famous for tracking shots. It's really well shot.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, I was watching this movie and I get toward the end of it and I won't spoil it for everybody, but I'm watching the movie and I'm like, this has to have been written by a Christian. It has to. And mm-hmm. I looked it up and it was.
Well, how about that?
Yeah.
So, yeah. We won't spoil that movie. We'll spoil Minority Report, but we won't spoil this one, though.
Tom Cruise runs. That's what he always does, right?
Yeah.
He runs like there's no tomorrow.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, Minority Report was a short story. It's available for free. It was written like in the 50s, though.
Is it Philip K. Dick, the Blade Runner guy? I think it is.
It could be. I can't remember. But it was, yeah, it was written like in the 50s. And I found a copy of it for free online. And it talks about like the precogs are hooked up to these computers and they have punch cards that come out. It's really funny. Hmm. In fact, the author put a little note and he said that he's going to update it.
As computers get updated.
He says that he's going to update it so that new readers are not impeded from enjoying the story because of the technological deficiency.
Oh, that's funny. Hmm. Well, I feel like that would be an unending update then, like –
Yeah,
you'd have to update it very frequently to make it work.
Yeah, I guess you get to a point where, you know, the story just needs to be rewritten or adapted.
Yeah.
Or recapitulated.
Hmm. I didn't tell you this. I've actually done a short course at high schools on science and science fiction and mm-hmm. how science fiction is more than entertainment. It can directly influence science policy and science research directions.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Is the Children of Men influencing research in fertility drugs?
Let's see. It's certainly a good – I mean, a lot of science fiction is dystopia.
Yeah.
Right? It's like if this technological change happens or if this disease happens, how would the planet respond? And it's almost always dystopia. In fact, the only example of a science fiction utopia is Star Trek.
Really?
Yes. Hmm. Almost everything else is a dystopia, but Star Trek is a utopia. We're all united and then we explore. What else do we talk about in the course? We talk about Jurassic Park a lot. Jurassic Park is kind of like that, just that perfect little balance of like, this is not possible, but it's plausible enough we can talk about it. And allegedly, there is some research team out there that is trying to implant a woolly mammoth DNA into a fertilized elephant egg.
Ooh.
So the elephant could give birth to a woolly mammoth.
That does sound exciting.
I feel like that would freak the elephant mama out. She'd be like, what the heck? What is this? What did you do to me?
That's true. I wonder if Neanderthal has gotten too far, like if we were ever to do that with a human.
People have talked about that.
Ooh, spooky.
Yeah. Well, that's what science fiction is for.
Yeah.
There is an example. I mean, the ultimate movie to talk about in a course like that is Gattaca.
Gattaca.
Gattaca is about, like, if you could engineer the genome of a child, you know,
Yeah.
And that has actually influenced science policy in the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
So clinics have opened saying, if you want a baby that has a certain eye color, if you want a baby that has this or that, you can come in and we'll do pre-implantation genetic diagnosis to only implant the eggs that are not prone to cancer or that have blue eyes or whatever. And they actually enacted policy, and the lawmakers specifically said, hey, we saw the movie Gattaca. We know this is bad.
Yeah.
And so it shows, like, science fiction is important. Mm-hmm. It guides the way that we – you know, think of the future, that we approach technology as a good or a bad thing and what needs to be regulated and what doesn't. What were we talking about?
I don't even remember now. It was Minority Report.
Oh, yeah. You got us off track with the movie thing.
I did, yes. I do like movies.
It's whether middle knowledge constitutes time travel.
Oh.
For the information. The information is going backward in time.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
So you said the precogs have middle knowledge to get away from the time travel problem.
Yeah, but it doesn't work whenever they project it. That's the problem. Because, you know, information from the future, you can't show a video of the future, which is what they were doing in that movie.
Hmm.
That involves materials because you have to have photons reflecting and all that kind of business.
Right, but aren't the precogs, they're effectively omniscient because that means they know not only what people will do, but all the circumstances leading up to what they would do. Because
mm-hmm.
conceivably, there's a set of circumstances under which almost anyone would commit murder. But not all circumstances obtain.
Yeah.
So that means the precogs have to know what actual circumstances obtain and what those free people would do in that situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's something that I was thinking about is that they do have to have some type of information input.
Yeah.
About, you know, the real world. Otherwise, you know, it wouldn't be middle knowledge. It would be some type of other future type thing or I don't really know. It's science fiction. So you can't think too hard about it, but just hard enough.
Right. It's like you have to think hard about it in the way the author wanted you to.
Yeah. But the thing is that God does have middle knowledge. Even though you're a Calvinist, I don't think that you would object to the fact that God does know what free creatures would do.
Yeah, the general concept of counterfactuals I think I'm fine mm-hmm. with. You know, there's even – well, I think this is controversial, but there are some biblical passages that seem to affirm the existence of counterfactuals.
Yeah, that's not controversial at all. There are three good ones that come to mind. It's Jesus – talking about the city of Tyre.
Yeah, if the miracles that have been done for you have been done, that's right.
Or Sodom and Gomorrah and the city of Tyre, I think. There's one where Paul says, if the rulers of this world had known, then they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. That has a lot of really interesting implications, depending on what you think the rulers of this world constitutes.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But the seminal example, the completely non-controversial example, is in 1 Samuel 23. David is on the run, and the men of Keilah, the city of Keilah, he consults God and asks God, if I go down to the city, will they kill me? And God says, yes. And so David doesn't go down to the city. And so that's an example where it's uncontrovertible that there's some type of counterfactual going on. But the thing is that if you don't think that the men of Keilah had libertarian free will, then it's not truly middle knowledge in the sense that Molinism means, but it's more of like you said, a counterfactual. God would determine what those people would have done,
yeah. Even though it's not actually going to happen.
Yeah, and roughly like saying, if you were to stand under a giant rock, then you would die if it fell on your head, kind of
right.
thing. You know, it's a completely determined system, but it is a counterfactual.
Yeah, I mean, my opinions went way in the Calvinist direction after reading a book called Willing to Believe by R.C. Sproul, mm-hmm. which talked about Augustine, who was basically a Calvinist, and Pelagius, who like denied original sin and said people totally have the ability to live a perfect life if they so choose. And Pelagius's argument was, if God commands it, that implies you have the ability to do it.
Oh, yeah,
command nice. Implies ability. Anyway, the Catholic Church kind of took this weird middle stance, and that's where the whole idea of prevenient grace came mm-hmm. in. I think prevenient grace is a goofy concept because it's almost like, yes, original sin exists, and we're going to undo it. And so, but then later, Luther in the Reformation, Luther came up with this great argument. He said, okay, why does God make commands? Is it to show that we can do it? Does it imply that we can do it? No, it's to show us that we can't. Command to show inability, to show that you have to rely completely on grace. And I thought that was a pretty solid argument. And really, you know, all of the later Calvinists, Calvin himself, Edwards, were just building on those kind of foundations. But ultimately, I think they were really zealous for this idea that God has to get all the credit for salvation. Mm-hmm. Once you allow for like people to lose their salvation or people to earn their salvation, then you're back into some kind of works righteousness, some mm-hmm. kind of legalism that the New Testament seems really zealous to stay away from.
This is part of where I think middle knowledge can be helpful is because, like you said, you have to preserve two seemingly incompatible truths. Mm. That people that are saved get no glory. They cannot revel in the fact.
Yeah, they get no credit. Yeah.
But on the other side, and this is where the Arminians really push hard, is they say that men that are condemned, they have to be responsible. Because once you make God directly responsible for the condemnation of men, then you're running into major problems where God is sending people to hell and they don't have an option.
Right.
So they actually have to be responsible.
Yeah, human accountability has mm-hmm. to be preserved.
I think that Molinism has the resources, depending on how you parse it out, there are different ways. I think that it does have the resources to preserve that sort of asymmetry. If you are saved, that God gets all the glory, but if you were lost, then
it's on you.
Yeah, you bear all of the burden there. Hmm. And so my turn to recommend a book, Salvation and Sovereignty, A Molinist Approach by Kenneth Keithley. He was a Calvinist who moved towards the middle knowledge perspective. And essentially what he does is he takes middle knowledge and just throws it at Reformed theology at all the little mystery spots in there and patches it up with middle knowledge.
I see. So is the idea to minimize the mystery spots? If your approach minimizes the mystery spots, then you're doing a better job of like accounting for all the data points without throwing up your hands and giving up?
Yeah, basically. It's, you know, explanatory power and explanatory scope and things like that. Mm-hmm. And so that's one thing for me. Even though I do affirm free will, a lot of people consider me, if they just talk to me and I don't say middle knowledge, they'll think I'm a Calvinist. Mm. In fact, I once said that I think that I really deserve to be in the quote-unquote Reformed camp because one girl asked me why people go to hell, and my answer made her cry. And so I figured that that's close enough to being Reformed.
Well, if you're in your 20s anyway, that's yeah. So, you know, what's funny, the stereotype is that people, you know, become a Calvinist, especially men, I don't know why they do this,
yeah.
become a Calvinist in their 20s and you go crazy and like go argue with people.
Yeah.
And
it's apparently a cage stage.
Yeah, exactly. They need to be in a cage. But this happened back in the 1500s.
Mm-hmm.
People would go to Geneva and learn from Calvin in their 20s and they would be like, oh, I'm going to go find someone to argue. And John Knox did it and exported Calvinism en masse to Scotland.
Yeah.
And now we have Presbyterians.
Yeah, yeah. I do like the Presbyterians.
I do.
I
like Scotland too.
Yeah, so the issue that I was saying with middle knowledge is that Calvinism and Reformed theology, broadly speaking, the things that it does explain, it explains very, very well. It has very strong explanatory power. So if you were just to match up Reformed theology to, say, standard Arminianism, I think that Reformed theology would win out every single time. The only reason that I include middle knowledge is because it increases the scope of the data.
All right, wait. Why does Molinism escape the whole boasting problem?
The boasting
problem? Because you still say, I freely chose to respond positively to the gospel.
The issue is that the choice is not, I choose God or I choose not God. The choice that is in Molinism is not between God or not God. The question is between resist God or do nothing. And that's not even a real choice. Well, let me explain what it is, and then I'll give you an analogy. So the way it works is that God's grace will draw people.
Mm-hmm.
And then those people can either resist that grace or they can – or they don't, basically. It's a null set. You know, they just resist or nothingness. If they are brought to God, it's purely by his grace and only by his grace. But if they are not brought to God, it's because they resisted whatever grace was given to them. In Calvinism, there's what's called ordinary grace or general
common
grace.
Common grace. Yeah.
I think that everyone agrees that that grace can be resisted in a certain sense.
Absolutely.
So think of it like this. There is a grace that is given to certain people. If they don't resist it, which is not really a choice, that's doing nothing, then they are brought to God. But if they do resist it, as Romans says, and they suppress the truth and unrighteousness, they know the truth is there, but they continually actively suppress it in their own being, then they bear the responsibility for that. Hmm. So here's an analogy. Imagine that there's a man who is sick, life-threateningly sick. He wakes up and finds himself in an ambulance, and the ambulance is going to take him to the hospital. He has two choices. He can do nothing, which is not really a choice because he would just continue to not do anything, or he can choose to bust out of the doors and die on the side of the road. That's kind of the quote-unquote choice that's being offered in the Molinist scheme.
I see. So let me make sure I understand. So if I have two ambulances going, one person does nothing and they make it to the hospital and they live, and the other person busts out of the ambulance, they're resisting, and they fall down and they die, then the person who lived can tell the other person, you chose poorly, but I'm not going to boast because I didn't really do anything.
Exactly.
So that's how it wipes out the boasting. Is
exactly.
that right?
Yeah. So the person that lives, his life, he attributes nothing to his life. It is only the doctors and the skills of the EMT, so the people in the hospital, that save his life.
Yeah. So I think the related analogy I've heard is like, God throws a life preserver, but you do have to grab onto
it. See, that's the wrong analogy.
Because you have to be active?
Mm-hmm. That's actually the inverse. If you do nothing in that scenario, you die. If you do nothing in the ambulance, you live.
See, but my difficulty is the analogies that the Bible uses, especially like in Ephesians 2. Mm-hmm. It's not that you're sick and you're on your way to the hospital. It's that you're dead.
Yeah. That's definitely the case.
So there's still a distinction between the two people based on their response. And I know you've kind of changed it to zero and negative instead of zero and positive.
Or positive and negative.
Yeah. But still, like, it still has this image to me of, like, you have a person who is dead in their sins.
Right.
Absolutely helpless, and God calls them to life.
Right. So the point of that analogy is only to demonstrate the asymmetry of responsibility. So like you said, in fact, I even cringe whenever I think a man who's sick, because that is not the biblical picture.
Mm.
The only purpose of that analogy is to show that the man who dies bears the responsibility for his death, but the man who lives does not bear the responsibility for his life. And anything past that is pushing the analogy too far.
So if you were in heaven and someone said, good for me, I didn't resist, you would tell them...
You didn't do anything.
I did better than that other dummy down the street.
Yeah, well, what did you do?
I didn't resist. No, he resisted. That was bad for him, good for me. I did better than him, good for me.
Well, by not resisting, you're referring to nothingness. You did nothing.
I know, but isn't... all right, let me ask you this then.
Uh-huh.
If this is correct, can't an Arminian basically say the same thing?
No. Because the Arminian is saying, choose to live. Choose you this day who you will serve. And they're pulling Joshua 24 out of context there. And they're saying, you have the choice. You choose God or you choose not God. And you're just in a neutral state.
Okay. So Armenians, classic Arminianism also believes that you can lose your salvation. So do you come from a Molinist point where you can lose your salvation or no?
So it's very important to make a very precise distinction here between possibility and actuality. What I think is that God uses his middle knowledge to bring about his preserving means. So in other words, Calvinists will agree with this.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
God uses means to preserve people.
Right. It's not just out of nowhere.
Exactly. So one of them is Scripture, the convicting word of Scripture.
Right.
The warnings in Hebrews, for example, Hebrews 6, I consider those to be part of the means that God uses to convict his elect to preserve in the faith. If those weren't there, then the elect would fall away.
Hmm.
So let me put it this way. God has chosen that his elect will not fall away. In order to bring that about, he has to do things. He has to actively preserve them. But if he doesn't preserve them, or if he doesn't include things that will preserve them, then they will fall away, or they would fall away.
Now, hold on. Your patron saint of Molinism, William Lane Craig, he doesn't go with you on this, right?
That is correct, and he's wrong.
All right.
He's wrong. Well, actually, no, he does go with this a little bit.
He says, like, I think he would say there are people who have been saved and lose their salvation, which it sounds like you would say that doesn't actually obtain.
They could, but they won't, given the fact. So if anyone loses their salvation, it is because God allowed them to, or they were not actually genuinely elect.
Right, that's what the Calvinists say. They were
Son of perdition, for example.
Yeah.
Now, what Craig is saying, and I'm going off of memory here, I think what Craig is saying is that people genuinely tasted salvation. Like, they genuinely tasted the fruits of the Spirit and whatnot, but they did fall away from that. And the difference here being that it would be like Judas, the example of Judas, that people would say that Judas had genuinely experienced that thing. The argument is pushing against the Calvinist idea, or the common Calvinist idea, that people will taste like the blessings of the covenant community, for example. They enjoy sort of the fringe benefits of being a Christian, but they don't actually experience the grace and experience of God. Craig is saying that in Hebrews 6, he's describing people who genuinely tasted the gift of God. They genuinely tasted God's grace, but then rejected it.
I don't know. I think the difference between Craig and you is Craig is trying to preserve libertarian free will across the board, and you're kind of extending God's mental knowledge to account for not only saving people, but maintaining them all the way through.
Yeah.
But what drives me crazy, and I think I mentioned this to you earlier, is that when you ask Craig, do people fall away in heaven? He's like, oh, no, they see such they're so captivated by the goodness and excellence of God that they never fall away. And he uses Calvinist language to describe it. Mm-hmm. So I was listening to him talk about this, and I almost drove off the road like, that's Calvinism. Ah! And so it drove me crazy. Mm-hmm. By the way, Dr. Craig, I know you're not listening, but if you are, we love you. You're awesome. You're wrong on this particular thing, but other than that,
Said, even as a Molinist, I disagree with him on core issues.
Yeah.
And you're right. I think that he's inconsistent there. But to sort of defend him a little bit, I think what he's saying is that it is a universal counterfactual that all people, if they were in the presence of God, they would choose to stay there. I think that's what he's saying. That is a free choice. It just happens to be a universal counterfactual. I'm trying to think of a parallel. You could say that if everyone were offered $1 million, they would freely accept it. Now, obviously, there are going to be a few exceptions, but that's something that, from our perspective, we can say that no strings attached, you get all the money you want. Everyone would freely accept that because it's such a...
Right, but it's not against their will or anything.
Yeah, it's not against their will. Yeah. It's just so obviously true. So I think what Craig is saying is that the goodness and beauty and wonder of God is such that no person could freely choose, would freely, rather. They could, but no person would freely turn that down.
$1 million.
I disagree with him.
Yeah,
I disagree with him.
By the way, this is off topic, but I was on a faculty committee, and we asked students this question, like, if you were given, X million dollars, what would you do with it? And no one gave the Lord of the Rings answer and said, I would...
Destroy it?
In the volcano, I mean, there's an argument for destroying it because it, like, could mess up your life, mess up every friendship you have, mess up relationships with family. So chucking the ring in the volcano is not a bad idea from that perspective.
That is true. Unfortunately, I would give the Boromir answer, and I would use it to defend Gondor, in which case I would mean I would pay my student debts, and then I would destroy it.
Oh, no, see, that's the whole point. And you're making the same mistake Boromir did, that once you say, oh, I'm going to pay the student debts, and I'm going to do this, oh, and also this good thing, like, no, you can't, you got to say no to it.
Yeah, that's true.
So Peter Kraft, the great philosopher out of Boston College, I remember meeting with him one time when I was in Boston, and he teaches a class on Tolkien. And on the first day of class, he asked people, if you found Aladdin's lamp and you got three wishes, what would you wish for? And you can't do that. Yeah. So everybody writes their answers down. And then he said, okay, that was the first exam. You all failed because no one wrote destroy the lamp, which is what Tolkien would tell you to do.
That's true.
Kraft, interestingly, also thought that what Tolkien was really warning against, or the application of what Tolkien was warning against in our day, is artificial immortality. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. See, I've always wondered about this because in the Tolkien verse, the gift of man is mortality. You know, that men, they...
Oh,
they
contrary to the elves, yeah.
Yeah, and I've always wondered, like, that never really jived with me. Like, I was trying to figure out what he was getting, but that kind of makes sense, I guess. The way I've heard it explained is that because the elves are tied to the music of creation, that they have no investment to actually do anything. Because they're going to be here no matter what. Mm-hmm. But men are free to do whatever they want, and they have a limited time to do it. Mm. So they're motivated. So maybe that's where he was going.
So to double down on the geek talk, yeah. Isn't it interesting that in the Harry Potter verse, what distinguishes Voldemort is his willingness to, like, mangle his soul, so to speak, for the sake of this artificial immortality?
Yeah.
Like, that's very much in line with the Tolkien way of thinking.
That's true, yeah. And Harry's choice, the way that he achieves, quote-unquote, immortality is ultimately by dying.
Self-sacrifice, yeah, absolutely.
Interesting. Well, I think we have exhausted the level of geek for one episode.
Yeah, you're right.
So this will be our appendix part of the interview.
Yep.
And I'll talk to you later.
Yep, awesome. Right, thanks, sir.